This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. 97% of scientists agree climate change is happening. We're largely to blame, and the effects are not as far off as you might think. Today, you'll hear about two surprising and mostly invisible ways that rising air and ocean temperatures are affecting life right here in New England. Later this hour, Fred Pinckney of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service explains how climate change is making the problem of environmental pollution even worse. We start, though, with the somewhat mind-bending idea that climate change may be altering ocean currents, with impacts on our weather and sea level rise. Joining me now in our Woods Hole studio is Scott Rutherford. He's an associate professor of environmental science at Roger Williams University, and he was part of an international team that recently published evidence of what they call, quote, an exceptional slowdown of the Gulf Stream. Scott Rutherford, welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks for having me here.
What drives the Gulf Stream?
The Gulf Stream is mainly a wind-driven current that comes from the tropical regions of the Atlantic up along the east coast of the U.S., and then sort of crosses over toward Europe and comes back down the eastern side of the Atlantic as the Canary Current. And as part of that loop that is the wind-driven circulation in the North Atlantic, there's a similar loop in the South Atlantic that spins the opposite way and a similar loop in the North Pacific that sort of mirrors the Gulf Stream on the west coast of the Pacific.
It seems pretty amazing to me to think that anything humans do could possibly change something of the scale of the Gulf Stream and these huge oceanic loops, these currents that you're talking about. Can we really slow down or potentially, I know the idea was out there for a while, maybe even stop the Gulf Stream?
Yeah, when you think about it, you know, an individual doesn't do very much, but when you put a few billion of them on the planet, things start to happen. And the Earth's energy balance is fairly delicate. The amount of energy coming from the sun to the Earth has to equal the amount of energy leaving the Earth and going to space if the Earth is to maintain a constant temperature. And if you start messing with that a little bit, it doesn't take much. You start messing with that a little bit, and you can have large effects on atmospheric and oceanic circulation because you're changing the overall heat budget of the planet.
And how does that heat budget then translate into, as you were saying, these wind-driven currents like the Gulf Stream?
Well, all of these are ultimately driven by the difference in solar heating along the equator or the tropics versus the poles. And when you start to change the heat budget, you start to change that distribution of heat. And we're seeing that now. We're seeing the polar regions warm much faster than the tropics.
So it's kind of an evening out.
Yeah. And when you start to change that gradient, that's bad. All kinds of strange things starts happening. For example, you go back 20,000 years to the Ice Age, to the last Ice Age.
Right.
That's a fairly subtle change, initially at least, in the energy distribution that kicks off a whole bunch of other actions.
How is an ice age subtle?
Well, the initial driving factor is a variation in the Earth's orbit that changes the amount of solar radiation striking different parts of the Earth at different times of year. It doesn't change the whole energy budget that much, but it changes the distribution. And as subtle as that seems, it's not like you're totally cranking up the furnace or turning down the furnace. It's just redistributing the heat a little bit. And that changes all kinds of circulation. It changes the storage of carbon dioxide in the oceans. It changes methane production in tropical environments. And so that subtle change in the heat distribution leads to a whole cascade of effects that result in, for us in New England, walking to Martha's Vineyard on a 1 mile thick ice sheet.
Okay, so this recent study that you published, you were part of an international team, some of the biggest names in climate science on this paper, and you call this a, quote, exceptional slowdown in the Gulf Stream. So how rare of an event are we talking about when you say exceptional for what we have seen in the past few decades with the Gulf Stream?
Well, that's one of the things that we did that's novel in this particular field of study was to take some of our paleoclimate data over the last about 1,000 years and to look at the patterns, the temperature variability, the patterns that we see in the North Atlantic and relate that to, I'm going to call it the meridional overturning circulation because I want to be sort of separate that as the Gulf Stream is a small part of that.
So that's the whole loop you were talking about?
This is a loop, but it's a vertical loop as well as a horizontal loop. So the Gulf Stream brings warm water from the tropics north along the east coast of the U.S., that warm water gives up its heat to the atmosphere in the North Atlantic around Greenland, Iceland, over in Europe, and becomes dense enough to sink to the bottom of the North Atlantic. That cold, dense water now travels southward along the bottom and actually enters the southern hemisphere. And so it's that sort of whole loop of Gulf Stream transport north, sinking of cold, dense water in the North Atlantic, and then a southerly transport of cold water that we're really talking about here, the Gulf Stream being a part of that loop, that vertical loop.
And how much has that slowed down in recent decades?
It looks about 15%. And that's actually not our work. That was Dima and Lohmann showed that the slowdown was about 15%. What we were interested in, getting back to your original question, how unusual is this? And so we can use our paleotemperature reconstructions that go back about 1,000 years, we start around 900 AD, to see how strange is this? And it turns out if you go back 1,000 years, you don't see anything like this long decline that we've seen in the past, oh, I'll say 70, 80 years or so. In addition to a very abrupt drop from about 1975 to 1995, that is from our data, the slowest overturning circulation that we see in the last 1,000 years.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Scott Rutherford of Roger Williams University about evidence for a slowdown in the Gulf Stream, what may be causing it, and what it could mean. So let's talk about the actual evidence that you have. First of all, I mean, you said it's another group who's documented this 15% slowdown in this meridional overturning circulation. How do you even measure that?
It's actually really tough to measure. There are a couple groups that are measuring the Gulf Stream directly. Tom Rossby has an acoustic Doppler current profiler on a ship that travels from the east coast of the U.S. to Bermuda repeatedly, and they actually measure directly the flow in the Gulf Stream.
What is an acoustic Doppler profiler? How does that directly measure the Gulf Stream?
It actually sends out a sound signal into the water, and that sound signal bounces off particles in the water. We may not think of it, but the sea is full of tiny particles, both biological and non-biological. And that sound signal gets reflected back to the instrument. And the Doppler shift, or the change in frequency of the sound that is reflected, tells the instrument what direction the currents are going and how fast. The Doppler shift is something that most people have experienced in their lives when an ambulance with a siren goes by them and the pitch of the sound changes as
right.
you go by. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what the instrument is doing.
Oh, okay. So, and having done this over and over, they were able to detect over what time period for this 15% decline?
Well, this is different. They've only been doing this from about 95 to 2000, well, through the present, it's still running. So it's a fairly short time window. Compared to what we did. And so they actually don't see much of a change in the Gulf Stream transport in that post-1995 period. And we actually don't either in our index of the overturning circulation. So we're actually consistent with them there.
And how do we then begin to look back farther when we don't have these direct measurements of the Gulf Stream and try to infer what it was doing?
Yeah, that's the trick, and that's sort of the fun part here, is how do you figure out what was happening 500, 600, 700 years ago when there were no thermometers out there, and certainly no acoustic Doppler current profilers? And so what we do is look at some of the computer models that show a particular temperature pattern that is associated with an overturning circulation slowdown. That pattern's also been identified in some of the instrumental temperature data that goes back about 100 years ago, a little over 100 years. So we have to look for a temperature pattern, because that's something we can reconstruct in the past using what we call climate proxies, like tree rings, ice cores, anything we can get our hands on that has some measure of past climate. And so we look at the temperature pattern in the North Atlantic that is associated with an overturning circulation slowdown. And that's something we can take back. Right now, the farthest we can reliably go back is about 1,000 years.
How controversial, if at all, is this finding that the Gulf Stream is slowing down and that the amount of slowdown we've seen in the past century is unique in the past millennium?
That's a good question. I don't read blogs, so since the paper just came out, we really haven't seen much in terms of the scientific literature either supporting or refuting what we found in terms of the long term. Certainly in terms of the last few decades, I don't think there's much argument that there's been a decline, although we don't see it. The problem is we don't have a long enough real measurements of the flow. We haven't been doing that for more than 20 years tops. We just haven't been doing it.
Right.
And so we don't have the exact finger to put there and say, this is it. We weren't measuring it then.
Well, then let me rephrase the question. How confident are you and your co-authors in this result, knowing that you don't have direct measurements on which to base your conclusions?
I think we're pretty confident. There's a lot of pieces that fit together correctly here in terms of the pattern that we see and how you come up with that pattern. There's a couple different ways you can do that and using the different paleo data, different methods that we use to reconstruct the past temperatures. And we get the same answer regardless of how we do that. So I think we're pretty confident that what we're seeing is real.
Do we know what is causing this slowdown other than generically to say climate change? Do we specifically know what's causing this slowdown?
We think we do. I mentioned that sinking of cold water up in the North Atlantic that was the warm water of the Gulf Stream. And that cold water is also salty, and it needs that salty coldness to get dense enough to sink to the bottom. And if you start spreading fresh water on the surface of the North Atlantic up there, it's not dense enough to sink anymore. It's too fresh. And so where do you get fresh water to add to the North Atlantic? Well, you start discharging melt water from Greenland or sea ice melt from the polar Atlantic, or maybe even some of the high-latitude rivers. But we're thinking Greenland might be playing the melt of Greenland might be playing a pretty significant role here in adding fresh water to the North Atlantic and causing the slowdown.
We've heard a lot in recent years about how the melt in Greenland is accelerating and some of the largest extent of summer melting of Greenland ice sheets occurring in recent years. And yet you're saying that you've got pretty strong evidence that there's been kind of a stagnation in the slowdown of this overturning circulation. How do you reconcile those two if the melting is accelerating, but we're not seeing the same kind of change in the circulation?
Well, there's a little bit of a lag in the ocean circulation compared to the melt. So you start of there's a little bit of resilience in the circulation. You don't just put one pulse of fresh water out there and everything shuts down. The ocean does have some capacity to clear out that fresh water, but if it piles up over year after year after year after decade, then you start to see the impact of adding all that fresh water. There is some evidence now that over the last couple years from another group that's measuring the overturning circulation, that it's recovered since 1995. We see that in our data, and I mentioned Rossby's direct Gulf Stream measurements. But it looks like in the last year or two, it's starting to drop off again.
So there was a study that actually came out a few months ago showing that in 2009, 2010, there was a really rapid, dramatic, estimated at 30% for just about a year or so, slowdown in the Gulf Stream. And the result here in New England was pretty dramatic in that we saw 5 inches of sea level rise in mm-hmm. some places along the coast. What's the connection there?
The sea level, people think of sea level as, okay, we know the tides go in and out and the sea level comes up and down with that. But if you were to take a trip across the North Atlantic from west to east, you would find that the sea level is not the same everywhere. It's actually higher in the middle than it is on the edges. And that has to do with how the winds move the water and the overall circulation pattern. But if you change those wind patterns and the overall circulation, you actually change the difference in sea level. And it's that difference in sea level that ultimately drives the Gulf Stream. That's a long story about how you get there. And so you could do that. If you actually change that sort of east-west sea level distribution in the North Atlantic, you can change the sea level along the coast.
Does a 30% slowdown in the Gulf Stream in 1 year, I mean, that's twice what you're saying is over the long term and already calling that exceptional. 30%, how worrisome is that? And could that be a longer trend, or is that just a one-year oddity?
There is quite a bit of annual variability in the circulation, so I'm not going to say that that's the trend. We just don't know right now. 30%, if that keeps going, that would be bad. Bad.
Bad. Okay. So we know sea level rise is one impact. Does the Gulf Stream affect our weather? Would we expect to see changes in our own weather here on shore with this kind of slowdown?
Yeah. Welcome to the winter of 2015, right?
Really?
Yeah. So one of the questions that we've sort of been getting after publishing this was, well, does this have anything to do with the New England winter of 2014? Really didn't get crank until 2015. And the answer is, the patterns are kind of right. So that this past winter might be more common than it has been, at least as I remember, in the past couple decades. It may be that very unusual winter isn't so unusual anymore.
One of the factors that a lot of people, a lot of experts said came into play with this winter was some extremely warm water off the coast of New England, farther off. Right around the coast, we actually had cooler than average temperatures. But as you get farther offshore, was that related to the Gulf Stream and potentially to a slower Gulf Stream?
Yeah, that's a piece of the pattern that we see that is associated with the change in the Gulf Stream transport, and also the pattern that we see that sort of explains this past winter. So that warm water that you mentioned is consistent with what we would expect to happen.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Scott Rutherford of Roger Williams University. We'll talk more after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. In the studio with me is Scott Rutherford, Associate Professor of Environmental Science at Roger Williams University and co-author of a recent study demonstrating an exceptional slowdown of the meridional overturning circulation. That's the larger circulation pattern that encompasses the Gulf Stream right off of our coast. Scott, we were talking about how a slowdown in the Gulf Stream might impact life here in New England, sea level rise being one of them, perhaps more extreme weather, winters and changes in our weather patterns. Are there other impacts that we might feel from a slowdown in the Gulf Stream?
Well, I'd be concerned, and I don't know enough about it. I'm concerned about the biological impacts in terms of fisheries. And the ecological issues of changing sort of that heat transport again. That's something that I would definitely be interested in seeing what happens. We already have issues with fisheries,
Absolutely.
All up and down the coast. And so we don't know what the implications are going to be, but I guess we're going to find out.
There's a longstanding idea that the Gulf Stream is part of what keeps the climate in Western Europe so mild. And in fact, I looked up a few articles, media coverage of your study when it came out. And in Britain, those articles often started with, the Gulf Stream is what part of what keeps us able to even live here, makes this a livable climate, and that could be changing. But the Earth Institute at Columbia University says that's actually a myth. So how much of an impact could a slowdown in the Gulf Stream actually have on Europe? How much of a concern is this for them?
Well, that's a very interesting question. That one is a little bit controversial, exactly what's going to happen here. Certainly, if you look on a map, the latitude of Boston versus the latitude of England, and you find out that England is much further north than most people think. It's sort of actually mid-Canada or mid-southern Canada. So it should be a lot colder than it is. And so there's definitely some heat transport that the Gulf Stream brings up from the tropics again, and some of that gets carried across to Europe to keep them, unusually warm for their latitude. Now, what that's going to mean for the future, it really depends. How much is the Gulf Stream going to slow down, and where is it going to go? There is an issue of how that water recirculates. Does it stay south and recirculate at the surface? Or does it flow now more northward and sink in the higher latitudes, bringing that heat to the higher latitudes? So you can actually divert the heat into different places, depending on exactly how the Gulf Stream responds to whatever forcing our actions impose on it in the future.
And we have no way of knowing which one it might do. Kind of as you were saying, wait and see. It's like it's a grand experiment.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly model predictions about what we would expect, and that some of those bring up the European, I don't want to call it an ice age, but a colder Europe. We're not sure.
Is there any evidence that this same sort of slowing and change in circulation is happening to other currents around the globe?
Well, that's a question I don't know a whole lot about because I'm an Atlantic guy, not a Pacific guy. There really isn't another. We talk about the Gulf Stream, and in the Pacific, there is a corresponding current that comes up along Japan called the Kuryosho, and does the same thing. It transports heat from the tropics to the higher latitudes. But the Atlantic is the only place in the Northern Hemisphere where we get that cold, dense water sinking all the way to the bottom. That doesn't happen in the Pacific. It sinks a bit, but it doesn't have this full sort of overturning circulation. That occurs in the North Atlantic and also in the South Atlantic around Antarctica. So in that sense, that whole overturning circulation in the Atlantic is fairly unique. It doesn't really exist that way in the Pacific. So I really can't answer that because there's nothing quite like it elsewhere on the planet.
These different loops, how interconnected are they? If you slow one down in the Northern Atlantic, could that potentially affect circulation in the Southern Atlantic? And could that then feed forward to the Indian and the Pacific? How interconnected are all of these different loops?
They're very interconnected. And actually, you mentioned the Southern Hemisphere, Northern Hemisphere connection. And that's quite a direct one, actually, because part of that water in the Gulf Stream has just come across the equator from the Southern Hemisphere. And that is then balanced by that deep cold flow that flows southward from the North Atlantic into the South Atlantic. So those two are actually quite closely coupled. And again, if you look at the surface temperature patterns, the actual instrumental data, you do see this sort of Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere switch that is associated with this overturning circulation. You slow down the circulation, the Southern Hemisphere warms up, the Northern Hemisphere cools down a little bit.
Do we have any sense of how old this circulation pattern that we see and think of as being the norm, how old that actually is? I mean, the oceans weren't even always here. So clearly there wasn't always this same circulation pattern.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Now we're getting into a different time scale. So we're going back to the opening of the Atlantic Ocean. So now we're talking tens of millions of years ago, at least. By the time you get an Atlantic that's a decent enough size to establish that type of circulation, I'll throw out a number of 50 million years ago.
And do we have any sense in that intervening 50 million years whether there have been, I mean, you say this is unique in the last millennium, do we have any way of knowing if at any other time in the 50 million years there have been other slowdowns and what their impacts might have been?
Well, we do have enough information from marine sediments over the past few hundred thousand years and looking at some of the isotopic properties of the shells, basically the remains of microscopic organisms. We can get a sense of different temperatures, different salinities that were there. We do see changes from glacial to interglacial time periods that seem to be reflective of either a stopping or a dramatic slowdown of this overturning circulation. And that goes back to this whole, we started talking about the glacial, interglacial heat transport and how a small change in the equator to pole temperature gradient triggers large changes in circulation. And that glacial, interglacial variation is part of that.
Is there anything that we can do about this at this point? Or is this pretty much inevitable?
I refuse to answer that question on the grounds that it's too political.
How is that too political?
Is there any? It's a very touchy subject. I'm not into telling people what they should do. Here's the scientific information. What you decide to do with it is up to you.
But on a scientific level, knowing whether or not there is anything that could be done would seem to be part of making that decision.
Yeah, but that's not my end of it. As you know, we're talking maybe some sort of engineering solution. I'm not an engineer. I don't really deal with how to mitigate these issues. Here's the issues. Now it's up to the policymakers, the engineers, to figure out if there's a way to deal with this, or do we need to deal with it, I guess is the first question.
You're a professor at a small college. You have a significant teaching obligation in addition to your research. How do you present climate change as an issue to your students?
I presented the scientific facts behind what we're seeing. We talk about the projections for the future and the different possibilities depending on what happens. And we have a discussion about, will we do anything or should we do anything? And I leave that to the students. That's for them to sort of figure out. They're the ones really who are going to be dealing with this. I'll be dead before it gets really bad. So it's an interesting question of what do you do?
In addition to teaching science majors, you also teach education majors who will then in turn be teaching even younger students. Do you have that same discussion with them?
I do. I try to have that same discussion to get them thinking about what do you do? What are the implications here? You know, there is some unknown. So you talk about the warming of the planet of a couple degrees. And people say, a couple degrees, not a big deal, nicer winters, I can deal with that in the summer, we'll just crank up the air conditioning a little bit. And a couple degrees, you know, it's not a big deal. And the couple degrees doesn't scare me a whole lot. What scares me is things like the changes in the meridional overturning circulation, the changes in weather patterns. California, it stops raining. It stops snowing in the winter. They have almost no snowpack that they rely on for their drinking water in the spring and summer. So it's not the 2 degrees or, you know, it's 2.5, 3.5, whatever you want to argue, what is the global average temperature increase. That's irrelevant. What's important is the impacts on the ground in a particular area of the world. It stops raining, or it rains a lot more, or it gets particularly hot in a certain area. It's those regional differences that are far more important than arguing over whether the globe on average is going to warm 2.5 or 3.5 or 4.5 or 5.5 degrees.
So understanding that climate change is not just global warming, not just getting a little bit warmer, but that it's a really all-encompassing change.
The critical part for humans and other living organisms too is the patterns. How are the patterns going to change? That's what's important, because that's what we feel. We don't feel a 2 degree or 3 degree or 4 degree global average temperature change. We feel what's happening in our neck of the woods, and that can be much larger than a 2 or 3 or 4 degree temperature change.
You're willing to say that these things scare you, but you also say by the time it really gets bad, you're probably not going to be around. Do you get a sense of a different feeling of urgency from your students?
Yeah, they're definitely concerned about it. We have the discussion of, will we do anything about it? And, that's up to, I have a daughter and she's 13 and she's going to be dealing with it one way or the other, whatever it is. So it's interesting to get their perspective on it. They get really depressed at the end of that class.
I was going to ask if there's an optimistic feeling to that question or kind of a sense of resignation.
I think the latter.
That's Scott Rutherford. He's an associate professor of environmental science at Roger Williams University, and he was part of an international team that recently published evidence of what they call an exceptional slowdown of the Gulf Stream. Scott, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Heather Goldstone. Up next, we turn our attention to environmental pollution and how climate change may be making the problem worse. That's coming up on Living Lab after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Consider this. A new report says climate change could make some environmental pollution more dangerous, and vice versa. Fred Pinckney is a senior biologist in the Environmental Contaminants Program at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Chesapeake Bay Field Office. He's also the lead author of said new report. Fred, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you, Heather.
What made you suspect that climate change could make the problem of environmental contamination worse?
Well, I was really just tracking the results of an international workshop that the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry held in 2011. And they specifically gathered experts from all over the world to talk about how climate change and contaminants specifically interact. And it's sort of like, I have a friend who, his tagline is, everything is connected. And so if people are managing chemicals, they have to think about how the amount of these chemicals and the effects of them are going to change with our changing climate.
One of the most dramatic changes that New England has already started to see as a result of climate change is a 70% increase in extreme precipitation events, the largest increase anywhere in the country. How could more intense rainstorms, more runoff, how could that affect contaminants in the environment?
Well, I also looked at nutrients as well, but specifically with contaminants, what we've done in this report is we've selected a few example chemicals and environmental processes. So focusing on mercury, if you have higher temperatures, some scientists think that you'll increase the rate that inorganic mercury turns into methyl mercury, which is the compound that accumulates in fish and those that eat fish, including people. So on one level, you'll have just more in the more toxic form. On another level, animals are stressed at high temperatures, and so they're breathing faster, and mercury can affect their ability to tolerate higher temperatures.
I know in humans, mercury causes mental or cognitive issues. Why is it of concern in birds? What does it do to birds?
We believe that, well, there's biochemical systems that are adversely affected by mercury, and perhaps some of the parental feeding behaviors are affected by effects on the brain. And then there's other pathways that birds detoxify mercury, and perhaps at higher temperatures, they're unable to deal with the amount of mercury that they could deal with at lower temperatures. There's a study by Dan Crystal in Virginia where he found that nestling, now I can't remember the species, tree swallows, I believe, when there was high temperatures during the young nestling period, there was basically one less nestling surviving per tree box, and this did not occur at the lower temperatures. So again, it's this sort of additive effect of heat and mercury, and perhaps heavy rain and mercury makes the young birds less able to withstand the stress.
Now, you said you also were looking at nutrients. Would nutrients with more runoff, more rainfall also be washing out into water bodies more?
Exactly. And so they'll end up in our estuaries. And nutrients have a whole set of complicated effects, cascade effects that they start. And what happens is you have sort of higher separation at higher temperatures between the top water and the bottom water. So with more nutrients, we end up with less oxygen in the bottom water. And with higher temperatures, we have less turnover between the top and bottom water. So that's sort of a double whammy. We also, with nutrients, the higher temperatures, the more runoff, the more nutrients often favor certain species of algae that cause toxic blooms, and that can affect both fish and birds.
Well, you cite in the report one statistic that's pretty dramatic, that between 1995 and 2008, the number of so-called dead zones in coastal waters more than doubled across the whole globe. Is that what you're talking about with these nutrients and the algal blooms? They create dead zones?
Right, the nutrients especially, but yes, so you have very low levels of oxygen in the bottom waters, and it becomes essentially uninhabitable for fish at certain concentrations. It's just totally lethal to them. At higher concentrations, actually, it may disrupt their ability to reproduce.
Now, you also, in the report, touch on the fact that changing temperatures and especially the sediment from runoff going into streams could be impacting freshwater mussels. So how does that work?
Well, freshwater mussels nationally are one of the most threatened taxa. And in the Northeast, many of these species prefer cooler water and clear flowing streams. So again, when you have higher temperatures, now you're putting them near the threshold that they can survive. And then when you have these more bursts of heavy rain, now you have more sediment in the streams. So both of those together can be toxic to these mussels.
Why are the freshwater mussels so vulnerable to begin with? Why are they already so threatened?
Well, they have a complex life cycle in that at early stages in their lives, they actually attach to the gills of fish and develop, and then they're shed by the fish, and some of them take a long time to reach reproductive age. So in general, habitat degradation, runoff in some places in the western part of Virginia, there's threats from leaching from coal mines or spills of coal dust. So in general, these animals are not doing well to begin with, and we're concerned that in certain habitats, both the higher temperatures and the more runoff may just push them over the edge.
Well, also in the freshwater realm, we've heard a lot in recent years about ocean acidification, changes in ocean chemistry caused by the ocean taking up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. But you also mentioned freshwater acidification as a problem of particular concern.
Right. And over many years, people have studied acid rain, and you don't hear so much about it now because due to the controls on emissions of sulfur and nitrogen oxides, there is less acid rain falling, and the region in the Northeast that's particularly suffered from acid rain over the years is the Adirondacks. Now, what has happened, one of our co-authors, Charlie Driscoll, has documented the recovery of streams and forest ecosystems in the Adirondacks. However, some of the acidic soils are near the surface, and if we have more bursts of heavy rain, some of the soil acidity that's more or less historic could be washing back into the streams and lakes, and so the recovery that we're experiencing due to emission controls could be delayed or perhaps even reversed from this changing weather pattern.
Heat and drought, of course, are other big concerns. We've talked a lot about increasing rain and runoff. But on the flip side of that, your report finds that certain toxic chemicals could make amphibians even more vulnerable to heat and drought, which are already stressful for them. What's the link there?
Well, certain amphibians, certain salamanders, and other amphibians actually have behavioral adaptations where they can sort of keep themselves cooler than usual. And it's possible that again, can be those behavioral adaptations can be exceeded when you reach higher temperatures. Just like people, you can tolerate so much heat, but if you keep running in 100 degrees, you're finally going to basically overrule your ability to adapt. We also have situations where frogs lay eggs in ponds, and those ponds are drying up. So when you have now less water to dilute whatever perhaps pesticides or other chemicals that have run off into these ponds where the eggs and larvae are, they'll see higher concentrations of these chemicals.
You really focused in this report on a handful of contaminants and species. Obviously, you can't do everything in one report, but it sounds like that just adding the stressors on top of each other is an idea that might be quite broadly applicable across many wildlife species.
Yes, and we put together a team of experts with different areas of expertise, and we had a workshop here when we started the project, and one of the first things we discovered was that there's many chemicals that we think would be affected, perhaps more release of things like polychlorinated biphenyls or petroleum products just from more runoff from streams. But beyond that, we couldn't say very much. So we really sort of had to focus on a handful of chemicals where we had sufficient published studies that we could cite. We're not saying that these particular chemicals or processes that we focused on are the only ones.
Well, and you focused in on the Northeast in part because you say it's more likely to be more affected, more strongly affected than other regions. Why is that?
I think the climate studies have shown higher level of sea level rise predicted in the Northeast, and some of the temperature changes seem to be predicted to be more rapid here. But really, my reason for focusing on the Northeast is our office is in the Northeast, and I was trying to get the attention of two partnerships that work on climate change issues in the Northeast. One is the North Atlantic Landscape Conservation Cooperative, and the other is the Northeast Climate Science Center. And these are partnerships that sponsor research and interactions with different management agencies to try to address the threat of climate change. And so what I was trying to do in this work was really to get their attention so that perhaps as they determine what are the critical issues to fund research in the future, that climate change contaminant and climate change nutrient interactions would be something they would consider.
How many of these problems are already happening, and how many of these are predictions of what you think might happen in the future?
It's some of each. So, you know, we know that, for example, for amphibians, a recent study showed that there are likely population decreases across the whole country, not just endangered species, but in common species of frogs like green frogs. So we know that's happening. We know that mussels are one of the most threatened taxa in the country. We know that certain bird species like the rusty blackbird, their populations are in trouble. We're not sure to what extent mercury is part of the problem. So all these things are happening now, and we looked at the climate projections, and we're really in an unstable period already. And so this paper was really trying to call attention to, it's not just contaminants separately, and it's not just climate change it's separately, but both together could be having major impacts.
Is there any good news in all of this, or even any reason to be optimistic about the situation going forward?
I think I'm hoping that this paper and the many other papers that have been published on climate change can sort of organize people to take another look at their own actions around their homes in terms of their carbon footprint, their use of fertilizers, so that they realize that they're part of the problem too. We are part of the problem. And perhaps the focus also on certain species, amphibians and mussels, perhaps will get people a little bit more involved in what's going on in their watershed, perhaps working with watershed groups and educating their children, such that, you know, an educated public is the first start towards really taking action to try to turn things around.
That's Fred Pinckney. He's a senior biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the lead author of a new report on the interactions between environmental contaminants and climate change. Fred, thanks.
Thank you.
And now for something completely different. Because we wouldn't want to leave you feeling hopeless and depressed, we thought we'd bring you news of progress in the fight against another global problem, malaria. According to the World Health Organization, malaria killed an estimated 500,000 people in 2013. One obstacle in slowing the spread of the disease is the fact that even patients who've been successfully treated may still be contagious for days or even weeks after they've recovered. Now researchers think they may have found a new weapon in the fight against malaria, Viagra. A new study suggests that Viagra may make it possible for the spleen to distinguish malaria-infected red blood cells and remove them from circulation. Senior author Catherine Lavazek says she thinks the public's interest in Viagra is driving a lot of the media coverage of the discovery.
If I found something for aspirin or something like that, I'm not sure that it would be in the media.
But Matt Marty, a malaria researcher at the Harvard School of Public Health, says there's more to it than that. There's increasing recognition that we can't just treat the symptoms of malaria. We have to put more effort into stopping the spread of malaria from patients to mosquitoes and on to other people.
10 or 15 years ago, everybody would have said, well, transmission is going to go away if we just treat. But nowadays, if we want to eliminate the parasite from a whole population, then we have to block transmission. And so therefore, I think that study is very timely.
Marty says trying to stop transmission at the human end is, quote, a perfect target. So how could Viagra help? What this new study shows is that Viagra causes the buildup of a molecule called CAMP in the sexual or reproductive stage of malaria parasites. That's the stage found in the blood and acquired by mosquitoes. But the excess CAMP changes the outer membrane of both the malarial cells and the human red blood cells they infect, causing them to become more rigid.
We don't have deciphered the mechanism in detail yet, but so far we think that the parasite itself becomes stiff, but also the red blood cell membrane, but it's triggered by the parasite.
Being stiffer may make infected red blood cells a target for capture and elimination by the spleen. The spleen's main job is to be a blood filter. Healthy red blood cells are squishy or deformable and can squeeze through the mesh of the spleen. Old or damaged red blood cells, though, are stiffer and get caught. In this new study, mesh filters did the same thing to malaria-infected red blood cells with high levels of CAMP. So the thinking is that Viagra treatment could enable the spleen to clear infected cells out of the blood. If there are no reproductive malaria in the blood, then the next mosquito who comes along can't pick up the parasite and pass it to someone else. You've broken the chain of transmission. But don't expect malaria patients to start getting Viagra treatments tomorrow.
It's not done yet. It's just a proof of concept. It's really exciting, yes, but there are a lot of exciting findings in the field. A lot of people work on promising drugs and vaccines.
Viagra's effectiveness against malaria still needs to be tested in mice and then humans, which Lavazek says they're hoping to start next year. They're also hoping to find a way to modify the active ingredient in Viagra to make it more specific so that it still makes the infected red blood cells stiffen up, but doesn't do the same to other parts of the human body. You can find a link to that study, plus more on all of today's stories on our website, capeandislands.org. You'll find Living Lab in the program menu. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.